Wisconsin Eye is in Milwaukee. We are interviewing Stan Stojkovich. He's Dean of the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UW-Milwaukee. Stan, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you for the opportunity.
I am curious about, I want to talk to you about your work studying and researching Milwaukee County jail inmates. But before I get to that, I was so intrigued by the New York Times op-ed piece. Tell me why you were on the board of Creative Corrections Education Foundation.
That was an appeal made to me about 18 months ago by Percy Pitzer. Percy Pitzer is a former warden in the federal prison system. He's actually from Wisconsin, Boscobel, originally.
Oh, raised in Boscobel.
Raised in Boscobel.
Site of the Supermax?
yes, so we don't call it that anymore.
Excuse me.
But he came to me about a year and a half, and I did not know him from Adam. I mean, he came to me and said, listen, I'd like you to join my Creative Corrections Education Foundation. I said, well, what is it? So he gave me some information. Then he gave me an article that he wrote in the American Bar Association Journal about how correctional policy, sentencing policy, legislative kinds of laws that were passed in the last 15 to 20 years make no sense, and they're ruining the federal prison system. It's growing too fast. And I agreed with his assessment. So then I agreed to meet with him about a year ago. We went out to lunch. I told him every time he takes me out to lunch, I'm a happier guy. I started talking with him about what his philosophy was, what he was trying to accomplish. Then he told me of this story about how his foundation, the nonprofit side, in which he put $150,000 of he and his wife's own money.
To jumpstart it.
To jumpstart the whole foundation with the idea of giving scholarship money to the kids of incarcerated people. And I thought that was such a novel idea. That was so interesting. I had never heard anyone really talk about it. And when you asked him about his motivation was centrally tied to, got to break the cycle. He believes this can break the cycle because as a warden, he had seen countless numbers of people, brothers, uncles, sisters, sons, coming through the correctional system and just a nonstop train. And he said, we got to derail this train. We have to go in a different direction. So I started to talk with him. He put me on their board, and then A led to B, and then we started to think about a scholarship fund here at Milwaukee.
Right.
And then we became actually the first university in the country to have an inmate-funded scholarship fund.
First university in the country, UW-Milwaukee?
UW-Milwaukee, that's correct.
Well, how does that work? Because you write in your New York Times op-ed piece, which just intrigued the heck out of me, your visit to the House of Corrections was when?
We visited with him back in early fall, October or November of last year. The idea was he wanted to make a pitch. You got to remember, this guy is sort of Johnny Appleseeding across the country. He's going to former correctional employees, current correctional employees, and saying, listen, I was one of you for 35 years. I'd like to make a pitch to the inmates to support this fund to help their kids. So he started in Texas, and now he has 23 prisons in Texas doing it. He went to New Mexico. He has a number of prisons there. He just finished up in Ohio. He started in Wisconsin. We're still trying to get him in the Wisconsin Department of Corrections. Mm-hmm. His initial overture to them was not well received. I'm not sure why, but I'm trying to pursue that through some other means to get him to come in. And his pitch is a direct pitch, and it's a 10-minute pitch. He walks in and he says, good morning, whether it's ladies or gentlemen. My name is Percy Pitzer. I'm a former warden. I worked in the federal prison system. I need your help. And then he tells him about what he's trying to do, what he's trying to accomplish. Now, some inmates will just be dismissive. They'll walk away. They'll drink their coffee. Others lean up and they listen to him.
Is he hitting them up for cash, for scholarships?
He's hitting them for direct money. And he's saying to them, the way you're doing this is through your commissary account. And I have a form here that your institution has approved to take out a certain amount of money that will allow you to donate. Now, you can give once or you can give every month. And he tells them, he's done the math. If 25% of all prisoners in this country gave $1 a month, all right, we could fund every child of an incarcerated person to go to college. That's how much money we would generate.
UW-Milwaukee is the first to partnership?
First to partnership with Creative Corrections Education.
How does that work from the UW-Milwaukee side? So you had to get cooperation then from the Milwaukee County jail officials and the bureaucracy, I'll use that term, at UW-Milwaukee. So how did that play out, sir?
Well, what we did was we went to the County House of Correction, Mike Hafeman, the superintendent. We asked him directly. He said, we'd like to be able to do this. He said, no problem. Come on in. Now, you got to remember, this is a 180 from where it was. His predecessor was running it in a much different way. Mm-hmm. But Mike came in with a different philosophy, different belief about the inmates, about the staff. So he said, this is an opportunity for us. At that point in time, he notified his boss, Chris Abley, the county executive.
Yes.
Chris Abley walked in that day with his personal checkbook and wrote me a check for $5,000 and said, I want to contribute to this. And then I also wrote a personal check of my own for $5,000. And then we got donations from people. Now, the way it works is this. We have a foundation here at UWM. Mm-hmm. That foundation takes in the money. So if a student says, I want to study biology at UWM, they don't have to study criminal justice or social work. Right. They can study anything. My father was incarcerated, or my mother was incarcerated, or is currently incarcerated.
Right.
Am I eligible? What we do is we have a relationship with the Creative Corrections Education Foundation. They ultimately run the process. They screen the applicants, and then they say, we want to give $1,000, let's say, to this person. If it's a UWM student, then we have funds here at UWM. We're building our own scholarship fund. So Percy Pitzer is building his nationally. Mm-hmm. We're building ours locally for those who are interested in UWM.
This is fascinating. So how much is in the UW fund here?
A little under $17,000 in 3 months.
$17,000 in 3 months.
3 months.
This can be used only to pay the tuition of students at here, UW-Milwaukee, whose parents are either have been incarcerated or are now incarcerated?
That's correct. Or on some kind of correctional supervision.
That's right.
That could be probation, that could be parole.
Parole, extended
but they
supervision.
Have been, exactly. They have been in the correctional system. So we say, all right, I can't support a kid who wants to go to Marquette, for example, because I don't work for Marquette. But I can encourage Marquette University to build a similar scholarship program, and that's what we're going to do.
Is the scholarship program capped at $1,000 per year or per semester or what?
No, right now it depends on the need. And that's a decision not made by us. That's a decision made by Creative Corrections Education Foundation. They say to us, listen, do we think that this person needs $5,000? Or if we have the money, then all we do is follow their allocations. Always say, okay, we have the money. Now, they can apply to his foundation as well, and he could give them additional money. Mm-hmm. We could decide, listen, we can only give them $1,000. Last year, he's given over 40 $1,000 scholarships across the country.
Are there students now attending this institution who are getting the scholarship money?
Not right now, because it just started.
But
we do have applicants. So we expect to see, beginning in fall, some applicants receiving money.
Will those who are admitted, will they have the same admission standards as other freshmen?
Absolutely.
So they have to have graduated from high school and show the proper scores and everything
They will
else.
Not even be considered by Creative Corrections Education Foundation unless they've been accepted to the institution. None of the money goes to them. They don't see a penny. It goes, once they're accepted, to their financial aid office or the bursar's office of the school, in this case, UWM's bursar's office.
Have you met with some of the students who are applying?
Not yet. We have a couple of people who apply. We expect more to apply as this has gotten out, because we're here in the city of Milwaukee. We know that a lot of the current students are probably eligible for this. Mm-hmm. It's now getting the word out appropriately. So we're doing all sorts of blitzes across campus to allow us, and we're just starting that.
You're a veteran of criminal justice studies. Why are you so excited about this program?
A, it's different. It's a little novel. B, I can't see anyone argue against it. There is no government support. There is no administrative overhead. 100% of the money goes to students. Why not enlist and encourage prisoners to help their own children? Mm-hmm. Why not have private philanthropy people? After the New York Times article hit, we've got money from Australia. We got money across the country. And that went into Creative Corrections Education Foundation. But we had a local limousine company donate $5,000 to us directly.
Well, let's talk about what you wrote in the New York Times. 13 women in H6, that's the unit there.
Housing unit.
In the House of Corrections, correct?
Right.
Donated a total of $41. One donated $5 a month. But I'm more intrigued, Professor, by when you went to the men's unit. That was B6. One inmate donated 12 cents.
Right.
Another 37 cents.
Right.
12 cents isn't going to go very far paying the scholarship, the tuition, room and board fees on this campus.
Right.
So 12 cents? Why?
Well, 12 cents is
what difference does that make?
Well, it's going to make a difference in large numbers, okay? When you get large numbers, again, if we can get 25% of the inmate population to give us the dollar, if they can only give us 12 cents, that's all they can give us. Mm-hmm. You got to remember, most of these inmates come from below the poverty level. Mike Hafeman, the superintendent of the Milwaukee County House of Correction, estimates that 80% of his clientele, the prisoners, are below the poverty level, both men and women. They don't have much to give. So where do they get the money from? And where does this money come from? You know, I mean, where's it sit? Well, it's typically a commissary account. Things that they would spend on deodorant, candy bars. And Percy Pitzer likes to talk about that. He likes to say, for the cost of a candy bar a month, you can help send a kid to college.
That's a pretty powerful message.
It's very powerful.
Where do they get the commissary money? Do they earn it, or do their relatives give them money that's for the commissary?
Combination of both. Since most of them are fairly poor, and they come in there poor, usually it's friends and or relatives who give them a set amount, and that varies by institution to institution. Now, in some institutions, they have to work. Wisconsin law, by the way, can coerce people to work for virtually nothing. They don't get much. They might get $10 a month. They might get a dollar a week working 40 hours a week, okay? And the idea is once you build that commissary account, you can spend it on those sort of luxury items associated with incarceration that you're not going to get vis-a-vis the state. That's not a state allotment. So people spend it typically on ho-hos, on deodorant, on shampoo, that type of stuff. But here, you've got some prisoners who are saying, I can give you 37 cents. That's all I can give you. And that's probably true.
Okay.
And the numbers here are the large numbers of people who are incarcerated. And that's the sad fact. But we can use that to our advantage.
What message do you think it will send the students who will be getting these scholarships?
That somebody cares. And that college education, I've said, should be for everyone. Not just the kids of incarcerated people, but that's the area that I specialize in. Mm-hmm. We are now in discussions with local people about funding for kids, you know, in high schools, in middle schools. Well, we can't do everything. This is our little niche that we have found that I didn't create. Percy Pitzer created. I'm just on board to assist him and to help. And so I've had conversations. I've sent a personal email to the governor asking him to get involved, get corrections involved. We've got former correctional employees here in Wisconsin who are retired who are now assisting us. Mm-hmm. We want to go across the country, and that's Percy's. I don't have time to do that.
Understand.
He has time and legitimacy. He's a 35-year veteran and a former warden of a major institution in the federal system.
You were there when he made the pitch, both to women inmates and male inmates. What percentage of them connected and bought into it and got excited about it and donated as much or as little as 12 cents?
My sense is that of the ones I saw, there were probably 20 to 30% who actually donated. And
they envisioned their kids?
Yeah, and in fact, many of them say, can you help my kids specifically? And he's going to middle school, or he's in elementary school. And Percy says, I can't. I can't help them. He says, that's not my mission. My mission is to help those kids who ultimately want to go to college. Because college education can break this cycle down the road. But those are needs that we can't meet at the present time.
Well, let's talk about the demographics. Give us a demographic profile of the average male inmate in the House of Corrections.
You're talking about a young man, typically under 30, lower levels of education, probably did not graduate from high school, at best may have a fifth or sixth grade education. Employment history, spotty at best, disproportionately overrepresented African-American, Latino, typically has some kind of substance abuse issue and or mental health issue, what we call co-occurring disorders, mm-hmm. Is a life that is not a good life.
Violent criminal, sir?
Not necessarily. If they're violent criminals, they'll probably wind up in state prison. This is a county house of correction. These are people who one writer years ago used to refer to as the rabble of society. They're the people who are not necessarily the most violent or the most serious criminals, but they have repetitive criminal records. They're into larceny. They're into burglary. They're into not paying their child support. They're into all sorts of issues. You know, I used to always say, like typically do say to my students, if a typical prisoner had one problem, education, let's say, yeah, I could help him. But he and or she has multiple issues that make responding to the complexity unbelievable. What runs through all of this is poverty. These men are destitute. They don't have much. And as a result, these types of programs, they can't afford to send their kids to college. That's not going to happen. And they realize that. But they also realize, listen, I've got an obligation here. And what Percy Pitzer is doing is sort of pushing that obligation and saying, listen, I'm going to ask you to do something, you know, ultra superhuman here. You're incarcerated, but I'm asking you to help. And we've got so far at the House of Correction a little under $1,000 raised through our efforts there.
Well, is there a disconnect? And here's my question. The dropout rate, as you're well aware, for MPS, for African Americans, is more than 50%, isn't it?
That's correct.
You have to have a high school degree or a GED to get into this institution, UWM, correct?
That's correct.
So, sorry to put it so bluntly, but are some of the children of inmates not going to be able to get in here because they've dropped out?
Yes, that's a possibility. And the fact of the matter is this is a system, public education system, not only in Milwaukee, but across this country, is in total disrepair, largely through neglect. Children are children. You give them the right tools, most of them can advance. But if you don't give them the right tools, they don't have the kind of family upbringing, they don't have a school system that's supported. The public school systems have been decimated in the last 20 years. We've gone to voucher systems, we've gone to private schools, and at one level, it's sort of a chicken-egg kind of thing, you know, right. Which came first. You know, I don't want to go to a school that's terrible. No parent wants their child sent to a school that doesn't perform. That's a terrible expectation. But a lot of these kids are going to fly under the radar because they just don't have the requisite skills. But, you know, many of the students that come into our university today are in the same boat. They are remedial in math, in English, fundamental stuff. A vast majority. Well, I shouldn't say
no, that. No, that's right. Because when I interviewed the chancellor last fall on the first day of school, he said for the first time, more than 50% of the incoming freshman class needed remedial math or English.
That's correct.
More than 50% for the first time.
Yeah, and then that's terrible. You know, what's happening? So we're doing all sorts of remediation. Excuse me. That's really been, I think, effective. But that's a long-term proposition. And the question becomes, where does large discussion and or debate about public education and the role of public education?
Well, I hear in the Capitol those who defend the choice program is saying it gives choices to parents. But now you have this explosion of different forms of schools.
Right.
You have virtual schools, you have charter schools, you have choice schools. Have those been good for some of the poorer children in the city of Milwaukee?
Probably not, but I don't know of any systematic evidence that has evaluated that one way or another, so I can't really make a definitive statement on that. My sense is that the people who are poor are just going to have limited access, even to computers, even to access something like that is going to be difficult for them. So we have to. The word is not out on that yet. That's still an early discussion.
So you would like to grow this program into the Department of Corrections. Would you like to grow it through the entire 26 campuses of the University of Wisconsin system?
I would love to do that.
What about the tech colleges?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, we have Percy Pitzer has had an initial conversation with MATC here in Milwaukee about, listen, many of these kids will probably start here. All right, let them start at MATC. Right? MATC can develop their own fund. They can support their students. And then we have great transitional programming. They can transfer to UWM once they're prepared in a particular area. Again, the scholarship fund is not limited to any particular major. Anybody can study anything. The goal is, right, to advance educational opportunity to people who would not otherwise have it. And what Percy does and the board listens to the stories. Each applicant has to not only fill out the appropriate paperwork, the application, but also has to meet with him. It doesn't have to be face-to-face, but they have to talk to him. And this is a warden. This is not someone, you know, who's naive. This is a guy who's been around the block a long time. So he asks questions. He comes out of those interviews. He tells me his heart's just at the basement, hearing these stories, the kinds of conditions that many of these kids are under, and then the difficulties that they face are almost insurmountable. How they even survive is a miracle. And again, the thing that runs through all of this is just abject poverty. And with poverty, it's the strongest predictor in long term of premature death.
Are you going to see some scholarship students here on this campus this fall? Or is it going to take longer than that?
We hope so. We hope so. We have applicants right now.
How many do you think?
I would say 2 to 3.
2 to 3.
Would be my guess.
Okay.
I want to have as many as there are out there who are eligible. Big part of this is you've got to get them to apply, which means you got to let them know about it.
Make them aware of it.
Yeah, that's right.
They have to be qualified. They have to graduate from high school. They've got to have some SAT or ACT
score to get into the school. We don't give them an application. Percy doesn't even give them an application if they're not accepted. They have to be accepted into the university, and no money touches their hands. There's no, once they're accepted and a financial aid package is developed for them, this goes to reduce their financial aid.
Okay, and it doesn't go to them. Let's come back to that point.
No, it does not.
One word I hear in the Capitol repeatedly is accountability. Who's the accountability cop for this program, Professor?
I am. So I have to make sure that those individuals are following. In fact, we're developing a research design to follow all these people. What happens to these people? And it's not just in the short term. Are they succeeding in college? We want to know that. Mm-hmm. If they're not succeeding, why not? Mm-hmm. But I would guess if they're going to have difficulties, it's going to be the same difficulties that we have with typical students.
Okay.
Whether it's remedial issues, adjustment issues, but we can deal with those things.
Tell me, 10,000-foot question. How often do you take your students into the jails and the House of Corrections? And what's the purpose of it, and what's the reaction of your students?
All the time. We have a separate course that I created many years ago just on jails, our local institutions of confinement. So I take them to the Milwaukee County Jail, I take them to the Waukesha County Jail, I take them to the House of Correction.
Why?
Because they need to see, especially if they're going to work in the criminal justice system. Most of these students are interested in careers in criminal justice. They got to see what jails are about.
Are they the next generation of guards or social workers or what?
They're all that. When we call them guards, they're correctional officers.
Correctional officers.
They don't like the phrase guard or
term
guards. Correctional officers, social workers, counselors, therapists, superintendents. There isn't a person who hasn't run one of these institutions that hasn't been a former student of mine. And I got them all over the place. In fact, a few days ago, I was sitting in my friendly cigar store, and a young couple walked up to me and said, "We were students of yours back in the 80s. We both became police officers because of you." Well, you can imagine how that made me feel. Really good. Made me feel, you know, well about them and about their success.
These are tough jobs. I just looked up the DOC population numbers. Mm-hmm. All of our male prisons are overcrowded.
That's right.
Up to they were built for at one number, and they're one-third to one-half overcrowded. These are tough jobs. Why do you tell them to take these jobs?
These jobs, and in fact, many of our students will not wind up, at least not in the long term. They may start out as a correctional officer. Many will wind up in law enforcement. Most of our students are interested in careers in law enforcement. They are tough jobs, but people who are into these jobs are into it. Yeah, everyone wants to make a living to pay their bills.
Yeah.
But it's really not about that for them.
Do they want to put handcuffs on people or what?
Well, you know, that's part. You get some of that. But the fact
catch
that
bad guys? What? You know,
well, they want to catch bad guys. But the fact of the matter is, after they get done here, they hope that they know that the bad guy concept is an ambiguous concept. Yeah. Bad guy can mean a lot of different things and a lot of different constructs. But, you know, what we have is a very elaborate internship field program in my social work department. I've got hundreds of field placements. I've got 300 people in the graduate program. It's one of the largest graduate programs in the state in social work. In criminal justice, I have probably got the largest criminal justice program at the undergraduate level, close to 750 students. Most of those students are not going to work in corrections. They're going to work in law enforcement. A small cadre will go to law school, will go to graduate school. Some will sit in this chair someday. Down the road. Not many, but I got a whole cadre of prosecutors in Milwaukee District Attorney's Office who are former students of mine. I got former judges, some retired now, who are former students of mine. I got them all over the criminal justice system. This department has produced a large number of people whose real mission is to have some kind of personal passion that's associated with crime and justice. Maybe ill-informed when they come here because they watch too much TV. Mm-hmm. And TV is not an educator.
How long have you been part of the school?
I've been here 30 years.
Over the 30 years, you optimistic or pessimistic the change you've seen?
Always optimistic. Have to be optimistic. Nothing good comes out of pessimism. You have to stay forward. Now, are there bumps in the road? Sure there are. But development goes like this. Up, down, up, down. But you're going up. Line is still going up. Okay,
but
that's how it works.
But Milwaukee is poorer than when you started.
Yes,
30 years ago.
Yes, it is.
The income gap
is greater.
Greater.
Yes, yes, it is.
So, what achievements are you proudest of? Because you're an optimist.
Well, I'm proudest of the fact that we can educate people, some of whom will have an impact on the criminal justice system. Now, do I have some kind of fantasy notion that they're going to have monumental impact? There are very few things in life that are like that. Incremental impact is the story of life. All right. You have a little bit slight, and that's what you can do. Now, I've always heard the phrase, if you can just change one person, I'm not that minimal. All right, I want more than that. I want individuals who are educated, who run these systems, and make good decisions based on evidence. I've said, say to my students, I've said this for years, a good criminal justice administrator, a police chief, a chief judge, a prosecutor, a corrections warden, an official in the Department of Corrections is a good thinker. If he or she is good, it's because they think well. My job is to make sure that they can prepare those.
The most recent population estimate I saw is we have 21,000, maybe 500 in Wisconsin prisons. There's a group in Madison, I'm going to ask you about 11 by 15, that we ought to cut our prison population from 21,000 plus to 11,000 by 2015. Mm-hmm. Do you support that? Is it possible, or is that not a realistic goal?
I support it. I signed the pledge, all right, as part of my optimism. Is it realistic? No. Okay. Is it going to happen in 2015? No. The fact of the matter is, however, unless you start somewhere, you will never get a handle on this. The only way you can get a handle on this is to really look at your sentencing policy, your sentencing laws, and how you ultimately make decisions on who goes to prison and who does not go to prison. When people talk about alternatives to prison, that only works, regardless of what the alternative is. Could be drug court, could be some kind of intervention, could be a split sentence or a suspended sentence. I mean, however you do that in the criminal justice system, the only way that you're going to save money and reduce the population is when you take Joe out of the prison, you don't put someone else in there in his place, or two people in his place. The analogy that a colleague of mine used to use is the only way you save money when you go to a used car salesman is not to go.
Well, two follow-up questions. We've got a little bit more, a few minutes left. Number one, I did a show last week that showed that the drop in the number of paroles over a 10-year period, 2002 to 2012, mm-hmm. dropped 90%.
Right.
Why? Bad thing or good thing?
It's a bad thing. Why it happens is that's pure politics. That is the pure interface of politics. The Parole Commission is accountable to only the governor. All right? Look at California. California used to have 125,000 people on parole.
And the federal court said,
that's enough. You know what they have now? 20,000. All right? Because they made political decisions, all right? Yeah, but that political decision was coerced by a U.S. Supreme Court decision, Brown versus Plata, that says you will reduce your prison population. It's the worst thing that can happen for a corrections person is to have a special master appointed by a court, in this case a federal court, to oversee you because they'll never go away.
I have a follow-up question. DOC data says 2,887 of those were sentenced pre-2000, before truth
right.
and sentencing.
Right.
And they also say 95% of those 2,887 were convicted of violent crimes. Therefore, they're saying threat to public safety if you put them on parole. Your response?
I think that that's terribly misleading. All right. They may have been convicted of violent crimes. We'd have to look at the analysis of that. But listen, we've got to manage this problem. What we have shown right now is that we haven't been managing this problem. We've been throwing people away and locking them up, throw away the key. Cost us a fortune.
$32,000 a year for an adult inmate in
right.
Wisconsin.
$100,000
for
a juvenile.
For yeah.
And what happened to the juvenile population? It precipitously dropped because the county said, we don't want to pay for it anymore. Did juvenile crime drop? No. We had to develop more creative strategies. And a lot of this is just tied to simply money. So I hate to just say the argument is about purely money, but for a lot of legislators nowadays, we don't have the finance for that. We can be more creative in the case management systems that we have when we monitor those people. Because we know from research, the best research done on this came out about in 08, done on 254,000 parolees in the state of California over a 10-year period. And what they found was if a guy's going to fail, he's going to fail in the first 3 to 6 months. So what does that mean? You have to watch them intensively. You have to be involved with them. You have to have good programming. If they get beyond a year and a half, 18 months, their chances of succeeding are very high. Most are going to fail right away. So that means better classification, better management, allocation of resources from institutions to community-based corrections, which is a hot, hot political and practical problem for the Department of Corrections.
Yeah.
But that's something that you have to do. Minnesota has done this since 1973, and they saved close to $3 billion.
And their prison population, I think, is about half of ours.
11,000.
Well, 11,000, thank you. Well, okay, final or next to final question. Why is it that Wisconsin incarcerates African Americans at the highest rate in the whole United States?
Well, there's a lot of reasons for that. But a big part of it, and it cuts across this country, this is a problem across this country. There are 7 to 8 zip codes in the city of Milwaukee that contribute 50% of all prisoners. And they're in Milwaukee, right? Guess what? That's not a revelation. We've known that for 60 years. That's nothing new. All right? How we've responded to that. Now, what's going on in those neighborhoods? Are these people just not committing crimes? They're all getting framed by the police? No. Right? They are committing these crimes. What's happening in those communities? Right? Milwaukee is a highly segregated city. Very segregated city. Very separated. All right? Mm-hmm. High condensed poverty. The world that many people, and I can take you right today into a zip code that they live in, is not a world of America. It's a world of a third world. It's worse than a third world in some cases. There is abject poverty, no opportunity, destroyed homes, destroyed families. Where are those people going to go? And if your strategy is to take your guns, law enforcement, and point them inward, right, into the city, mm-hmm. right, and keep them in the city, contain this problem, right? That's what we've effectively done. So it doesn't surprise me that 50% of all inmates in the state of Wisconsin come from 8 zip codes. 75% come from 3 counties out of 72. Guess what they are? Racine, Kenosha, and Milwaukee. 3 out of 4 inmates.
So it's a systemic top-to-bottom issue.
Oh, absolutely.
Is there a will, final question because we're out of time, is there a will to address this and change it? Or given the politics, given the political dialogue right now, that's the way it's going to stay.
My sense is that there is no political will. There is technical skill to address these issues. We can get people to manage decisions better, make better decisions about this. But there has never been the political will to do this. And what we need is leadership. That's what leadership really is. Sustained political will to address these concerns. They're tough. In California, they're forced by a court. Mm-hmm. A conservative court. In the Brown Plata decision was a 5-4 decision. Nobody who was conservative in California ever expected a Supreme Court to tell them now you're going to report to the United States Supreme Court and reduce your prison population by 40,000. They have been non-compliant in the last order. They were supposed to get down to 137.5% of capacity. They were operating at 200% capacity. And they got to 140. And the governor there said, we're done. Well, that's fine, but you can't say that to the United States Supreme Court. Because they'll just issue a mandamus act, and they'll tell you to do certain things.
Right.
And what's happening there is revolutionary right now. I'm working out there with the police chiefs for prisoner reentry programs. I used to run a leadership institute for the California Department of Corrections for 10 years, from Milwaukee, from 94 to 04. And so I know that department in and out very, very well.
But 30 years later, you're still optimistic.
You got to be. Okay. Because what's the alternative?
I understand. Professor Stan Stojkovich, Dean of the Helen Bader School of Social Welfare at UW-Milwaukee. Thanks for sharing your enthusiasm with Wisconsin Eye.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.